Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 32, which I will entitle A King Will Reign in Righteousness. I give you a heads up on where we're going with this. I'm going to say that this king is Hezekiah, who is a type of the Messiah Jesus. The commentators, of course, are split all over the place, but just to keep our sanity as we go through this, let's just keep that theme in mind. We start now in Isaiah 32, verses 1 through 2. Hezekiah begins, "See, a king will reign in righteousness, and rulers will rule with justice. Each man will be like a shelter from the wind and a refuge from the storm, like streams of water in the desert and the shadow of a great rock in a thirsty land." Now, who is this king who will reign in righteousness? I'm going to give you three options, the first two of which are not accurate, and the third of which is, in my humble opinion, the correct option. Option number one, this king who will reign in righteousness is referring to Jesus alone, not to Hezekiah, but to the Messiah alone. This is the pulpit commentary's view. Option number two is this king refers to Hezekiah alone, with no typical reference to Jesus the Messiah. Barnes, Kyle, and Delitzsch believe that this king is Hezekiah, nobody else. The pulpit commentary denies that. They say it's Jesus alone. The third option is that this king is Hezekiah, who is a type of Jesus who is to come. This apparently is the majority view. It's the view that I hold to too, fortunately. Here are five commentaries who hold to the idea that Hezekiah is referred to as this king who is a type of Jesus: Clark, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, Benson, Ellicott, and Poole, and Barnes, who says that verses 3 and 4 refer to happier times than that which existed under Hezekiah, and so therefore Hezekiah is a type of something better to come. Well, let's go back and look at these options again. It's Jesus alone, says the pulpit commentary. Here's some messianic scriptures out of the Old Testament prophets. Hosea 3:5. "Afterward, the people of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They will come with awe to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days." Of course, the last days there means the last days of the Jewish kingdom, the establishment of the New Testament kingdom. And so that would refer to Jesus. Zechariah 9:9. "Rejoice greatly, daughter Zion. Shout in triumph, daughter Jerusalem. Look, your king is coming to you. He is righteous and victorious, humble and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." Well, that obviously refers to Jesus. Isaiah 11:3 through 5. "His delight will be in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes. He will not execute justice by what he hears with his ears. But he will judge the poor righteously and execute justice for the oppressed of the land. He will strike the land with discipline from his mouth, and he will kill the wicked with a command from his lips. Righteousness will be a belt around his loins. Faithfulness will be a belt around his waist." Well, there's no question that many Old Testament prophets prophesied directly of Jesus, but I don't think that's the case here. In fact, Albert Barnes and Colin Delitzsch say that there's no reference at all to Jesus the Messiah. The reference is to Hezekiah alone. Barnes gives three arguments in favor of that proposition. Argument number one, this chapter is immediately connected with the previous chapter, and the previous chapter 31 dealt with the destruction of Sennacherib. Now, people debate that. I haven't even been talking about, is this chapter a part of the last chapter? Are these three prophecies one prophecy that was given over the space of three chapters and all that? I don't care. Nobody knows. They all disagree. But Barnes says that the previous chapter was about Sennacherib, so that makes him think that this is talking about Hezekiah, whose righteous reign flourished after Sennacherib's defeat in 701 B.C. Barnes says that everything fits with the happy times of Hezekiah's reign. That's argument number two. And argument number three, there are statements in this prophecy which cannot be applied directly or with propriety literally to the times of the Messiah. Now, Barnes doesn't say which statements he thinks don't fit the times of the Messiah, but I speculate he's referring to Isaiah 32, verse 14, which says this. Verse 14 of this very same chapter we're looking at. "For the palace will be forsaken, the busy city abandoned, the hill and watchtower will become barren places forever." Well, if that busy city is Jerusalem, well, then this doesn't refer to Jesus' time, because Jerusalem wasn't abandoned in Jesus' time. The hill and the watchtower, barren places forever? No. Jerusalem was a bustling city in the time of Jesus. Jerusalem wasn't the joy of wild donkeys and a pasture for flocks, in other words, totally devastated. However, against Barnes, if you take city to refer to a city in Judah outside of Jerusalem that Sennacherib whacked so that it would become a barren place forever, that's not a problem. That actually was the case in Jesus' time. Some of those cities were knocked down and were barren, and there's not a problem. The Cambridge commentator has an interesting comment here. They say that much has been made of the fact that the figure of the Messianic King, here in verse 1 of chapter 32 of Isaiah, this Messianic King is less idealized than in the great prophecies of Isaiah 9, Emmanuel, and Isaiah 11, the branch. Those prophecies obviously refer to the Messiah, and this one doesn't obviously refer to the Messiah. And much has been made of that fact. According to Cambridge, Will Barnes makes something of it. He says this is not referring to the Messiah. Well, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, no, we can't say that it's Hezekiah alone to whom Isaiah is referring. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's argument goes this way. They say that Hezekiah is already on the throne, but this prophecy speaks of future events. In other words, the idea is this prophecy is taking a bad, bad situation and turning it into good. Well, I would just argue against that. This verse doesn't say the king will begin to reign in righteousness. It just says the king will reign in righteousness. In the future, there will be a king who reigns in righteousness, and Hezekiah will reign in righteousness. It never says that he will begin to reign in righteousness after a period of tyranny beforehand or after a period of idolatry beforehand. So I don't think that's a good argument, in my humble opinion. Benson argues that it can't be Hezekiah that's referred to by Isaiah because, quote, it is easy to observe that his, Hezekiah's, government was as good before that time as afterward, and that in the very beginning of his reign, he ruled with righteousness and the fear of God. Well, again, I say, so what? Just because Hezekiah ruled during his entire reign righteously, that doesn't contradict verse 1, a king will reign in righteousness. Yeah, he's reigning in righteousness in the future, just like he did at the beginning. What does it say? He started out evil. Well, you could say that verses 5 through 7 refers to the previous reign of Ahaz. A fool will no longer be called a noble nor a scoundrel said to be important. For a fool speaks foolishness and his mind plots iniquity. And then Hezekiah takes over. And he rules righteously from beginning to end. There's nothing that contradicts a righteous rule of Hezekiah from beginning to end, in my humble opinion. Now, if you take verses 5 and 6 in Isaiah 32 as referring to Hezekiah's reign, you do have a problem because it says a fool will no longer be called a noble. So that sounds like things were bad during Hezekiah's reign, and I'm sure that's what these commentators are going after. But that's flimsy evidence. I think I answered it. That's referring to Ahaz's time, not Hezekiah's time. And so, Hezekiah could be in mind in this prophecy, a king. Hezekiah will reign in righteousness. But now, is it Hezekiah alone? Well, that leads me to option 3. I take it to be Hezekiah as a type of Jesus. And so does Clark, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, Benson, Ellicott, and Poole. Barnes says that verses 3 and 4, the eyes of those who see will not be closed, and the ears of those who hear will listen. The reckless mind will gain knowledge, and the stammering tongue will speak clearly and fluently. That speaks of happier times than that which existed under Hezekiah, although I don't know how you judge such things. I think it refers to Hezekiah's time as well as Jesus' time. But we know, of course, that in Jesus' time it's even better, because the antitype is always greater than the type. The reality is always greater than the shadow. All right, so after that long discussion, we're going to assume that this chapter refers to the reign of Hezekiah after Sennacherib's defeat in 701 B.C., and that is all a type of Jesus' victory when he establishes the New Covenant Church. In verse 2, at the end of verse 1, we see that rulers will rule with justice. What are those rulers? Well, first of all, they're officers under Hezekiah, as Barnes, Benson, and Ellicott affirm. But, of course, that could be typically referring to ministers of the gospel who are ruling under the Messiah. I don't know if you can carry the type-antitype scheme that far, but Gill does. These rulers will rule with justice. Those are Hezekiah's rulers. They're going to establish justice in the kingdom. We see that in 2 Kings 18, verses 3 through 6. Hezekiah did what was right in the Lord's sight, just as his ancestor David had done. He removed the high places, he shattered the sacred pillars, and cut down the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake that Moses made, for the Israelites burned incense to it up to that time. Moses called it Nehushtan. Hezekiah trusted in the Lord God of Israel. Not one of the kings of Judah was like him, either before him or after him. He remained faithful to Yahweh and did not turn from following him, but kept the commands the Lord had commanded Moses. So, a king will reign in righteousness and rulers will rule with justice. Verse 1 fits Hezekiah perfectly. Verse 2, each man will be like a shelter from the wind. We have a translation issue here. Some translate, as the NIV does here, as each man, God's Word, New American Bible, NASB, Young's Literal Translation, Holman Christian Study Bible, but a few translations translated as a man. A man will be like a shelter from the wind. American Standard Version does that, the Bible in Basic English, the KJV. Well, if it's a man will be like a shelter, Barnes says that means that this is a reference to Hezekiah. I saw one commentator, I didn't write it down, but he said that you could say instead of a man, the man will be like a shelter, referring to Hezekiah. But let's assume it's each. What are our options here? Each man will be a shelter from the wind. I've already mentioned Hezekiah as an option if it's a Benson, but here's some other options. It could be each of Hezekiah's princes will be a shelter from the wind. Benson says that. It could be Hezekiah and his princes together. Pulpit commentator denies that. And the pulpit commentator suggest a third option is referring to the Messiah only. That, of course, would assume a translation of a, not each. So we're going to take it this way. Each man, each ruler plus his king, the king and the rulers together, will be like a shelter from the wind and a refuge from the storm. That was like Hezekiah and his administration, like streams of water in the desert and the shadow of a great rock in a thirsty land. Great rock and hot blazing sun creates a wonderful shadow in a desert, a thirsty land, and you can get under that rock and rest in the shade. We go now to Isaiah 32, 3 through 8. Then the eyes of those who see will no longer be closed, and the ears of those who hear will listen. The mind of the rash will know and understand, and the stammering tongue will be fluent and clear. No longer will the fool be called noble, nor the scoundrel be highly respected, for the fool speaks folly. His mind is busy with evil. He practices ungodliness and spreads error concerning the Lord. The hungry he leaves empty, and from the thirsty he withholds water. The scoundrel's methods are wicked. He makes up evil schemes to destroy the poor with lies, even when the plea of the needy is just. But the noble man makes noble plans, and by noble deeds he stands. In verse 3, the eyes of those who see will no longer be closed. Well, who are those who are now seeing, but who didn't see before? Jameson Fawcett Brown suggests it's prophets. Gill says it's righteous people in general. I think Gill is right. And again, I think this is referring not only to Hezekiah's time, but to the Messiah's time. People are going to start seeing the light. The minds of the rash will know and understand in verse 4. The stammering tongue will be fluent and clear. That will be a prophet speaking truth, or a teacher of God's righteousness speaking truth that everybody can understand. We can hear and understand, and we can speak so that people can understand. Verse 5, no longer will the fool be called noble. Gosh, that sounds like some people in the current administration that I know. Oh, they're doing such a wonderful job, and they're absolute morons. No longer will the fool be called noble, nor the scoundrel be highly respected. Again, I could easily make an application to present-day America. For the fool speaks folly, his mind is busy with evil. Oh, still thinking about America, I need to get my mind back on the times of either Hezekiah or the times of the Messiah or the times of Ahaz before Hezekiah. The point is that righteousness is going to prevail over foolishness and evil and ungodliness. Those who practice ungodliness and spread error concerning the Lord, bye-bye. Those who don't feed the hungry and give water to the thirsty, those who have wicked methods, scoundrels, who come up with evil schemes to destroy the poor. And this, of course, is the ultimate injustice. When somebody's poor and needy and you don't help them out, that's the worst you can do, assuming the plea of the needy is just. But even when that's so, the evil people don't help the needy. But verse 8, but the noble man makes noble plans, and by noble deeds he stands. And I'm assuming that the noble men would be the noble men of Hezekiah's administration, including Hezekiah himself, and of course applied to the time of Jesus' New Covenant Church. Now these fools who are blasted here by Isaiah are said to be by Adam Clark, the pampered, fattened, brainless fellow who eats to live and lives to eat, who will scarcely part with anything, and that which he does give, he gives with an evil eye and a grudging heart. Isaiah continues with a little bit of doom and gloom. Verse 9, you women who are so complacent, rise up and listen to me, you daughters who feel secure. Hear what I have to say. In little more than a year, you will feel secure. In a little more than a year, you who feel secure will tremble. The grape harvest will fail, and the harvest of fruit will not come. Tremble, you complacent women. Shudder, you daughters who feel secure. Strip off your clothes. Put sackcloth around your waist. Beat your breast for the pleasant fields, for the fruitful vines, and for the land of my people, a land overgrown with thorns and briars. Yes, mourn for all houses of merriment and for this city of revelry. Now we need to take up verse 13, which refers to this city of revelry in the NIV translation. That makes it sound like Jerusalem, this city. And some people take it that way. However, if you look at the Holman Christian Study Bible translation, it gives you the option of not taking this for Jerusalem. Isaiah 32:13 in the Holman Christian Study Bible says, for the ground of my people growing thorns and briars, indeed for every joyous house in the joyful city. Well, that could just be a generic city, not necessarily Jerusalem. And that does matter because if you say, as we look at the next verses, if you say that this noisy city is deserted, how does that fit the times of Messiah? And that ruins the messianic implications of Isaiah 32. So we're going to take it as a generic city. All the cities of Judah who were being attacked by Sennacherib beginning in 703 BC. Verse 9, you women who are so complacent. Isaiah's picking on the women now. Who are so complacent. They're sunk in their pride, their luxury, their superstition. Some people think it refers to the men who have become effeminate. I don't think so. Kind of like golfers like to joke with their opponents, male golfers, when their opponents don't have the guts to take a hard shot. They call them Susie or Sally, or like Tiger Woods did recently, slip them a tampon. But I don't think so. I think he's just talking about the women in these cities. You daughters who feel secure, and some people think that refers to the smaller cities around Jerusalem. As I said, the city is referring to a generic city in Judah. If I take daughters that way, daughters of Jerusalem, satellite cities, then my case is strengthened. But I really don't think that's what Isaiah meant. I think he's talking about literal daughters. Isaiah says, you better listen to me, ladies. In a little more than a year, you who feel secure will tremble. Options as to what that year refers to. Option number one, 1 year till Sennacherib's invasion. Now, Sennacherib invaded Judah in 703 and got around to investing Jerusalem in 701. So this would be roughly 704 when Isaiah was speaking, if we take that option. Sennacherib does take that option, but Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown does take that option. But then he says the invasion was 714 BC instead of 703. Those dates suggested by old commentators, of course, are suspect. A lot of work on chronology hadn't been done then back in the 19th century. But that's one option. One more year, Sennacherib's coming. Option number two, the troubles will last more than 1 year during Sennacherib's invasion. That would require a different translation than the NIV, for example, the American Standard Version. For days beyond a year shall ye be troubled, ye careless women, for the vintage shall fail, the ingathering shall not come, for days beyond a year. In other words, you're going to be having trouble gathering your grapes and your crops because Sennacherib's going to be marching all over Judah starting in 703 BC, and it's going to last more than a year, which it did because he invested Jerusalem in 701, so that's more than a year. So I think that's the correct option. Now here's some off-the-wall options. The troubles that will last more than a year, it refers to the Roman invasion, not Sennacherib's invasion, but the Roman invasion of AD 70. Gill denies that because the troubles with the Romans lasted more than 1 year. If you read the Jewish War, you'll know that's true, so that can't be it. Adam Clark says it's the Babylonian invasion of 586. No, we're going to stick with Sennacherib. Verse 11, Isaiah says, "Tremble, you complacent women. Shudder, you daughters who feel secure. Strip off your clothes." Now, that doesn't mean he wants them to go get an OnlyFans account and do a striptease in front of a webcam. He means strip off your festive garments and put on sackcloth. Sackcloth, of course, is the traditional garment for mourners. And in verse 12, Isaiah tells these women, "Beat your breast for the pleasant fields." In other words, they're not pleasant anymore because there's no harvest there. "Beat your breast for the fruitful vines." Why? Because the harvest of fruit will not come. Now, I've got to take a little rabbit trail here and give you the King James translation here. For "beat your breast," this is what the King James says. "They shall lament for the tits." Can you believe that? "They shall lament for the tits." And there are people out there who are telling me that the King James Version is the only inspired version, inspired by the Holy Spirit, that I ought to be using. Am I going to raise my kids and tell my kids, "Hey, they shall lament for the tits"? I don't think so. That's worse than "the man who pisses against a wall" in the King James Version. That's the best way to stop a KGV person, in my opinion. Don't get into an argument. Just say, "Come on, man. I don't want to use such coarse language." For all of you who think that the King James is so elegant and so poetic, "they shall lament for the tits." Yeah, that's real poetic. Well, if that's the correct translation, that could mean that the women are lamenting because the farm beasts are no longer giving milk, so they're lamenting for the tits of the farm beasts that are dried up. Or it could mean that they are lamenting for their own tits. Oh, excuse me for talking that way, but I'm in the King James Version now. The women's breast would dry up so they couldn't feed their children. No, they're beating their breast, not their bosoms, but their chest. They're beating their chest as a sign of mourning. Isaiah tells them in verse 13 to beat their breast for the land, a land overgrown with thorns. Of course, that's the typical symbol of a land that's not profitable. And again, I'm referring to the time of Sennacherib. Let's read about Sennacherib's invasion of Judah on his way to Jerusalem, 703 to 701 B.C. Isaiah 7, verses 20 through 25. Now, I'm going to quote this. Some commentators don't think this verse refers to Sennacherib, but I'm going to take it that way. "On that day, the Lord will use a razor hired from beyond the Euphrates River, the king of Assyria, to shave the head, the hair on the legs, and to remove the beard as well. On that day, a man will raise a young cow and two sheep, and from the abundant milk they give, he will eat butter, for every survivor in the land will eat butter and honey. And on that day, every place where there were 1,000 vines worth 1,000 pieces of silver will become thorns and briars." The idea about the butter, it means that there's no crops. You just have to get what you can from your single cow. "A man will go there with bow and arrows, because the whole land will be thorns and briars. You will not go to all the hills that were once tilled with a hoe for fear of the thorns and briars. Those hills will be places for oxen to graze and for sheep to trample." Well, there's your oxen. Well, there's your thorns and briars. Isaiah says in Isaiah 32, verse 13, "Beat your breast, women, for a land overgrown with thorns and briars." Isaiah concludes verse 13 by saying, "Women, mourn for all houses of merriment." Well, what would houses of merriment in the joyful city be? Well, they could be public taverns. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say there are public taverns outside of Jerusalem, and that's the way I take it, too. It's not referring to Jerusalem. It could refer to private houses of nobles, houses of merriment. So we move now to Isaiah 9, verse 14, starting there and finishing up at verse 20, and we will be finished with this chapter. Isaiah continues, "The fortress will be abandoned, the noisy city deserted. Citadel and watchtower will become a wasteland forever, the delight of donkeys, a pasture for flocks, till the Spirit is poured upon us from on high, and the desert becomes a fertile field, and the fertile field seems like a forest. Justice will dwell in the desert, and righteousness live in the fertile field. The fruit of righteousness will be peace. The effect of righteousness will be quietness and confidence forever. My people will live in peaceful dwelling places, in secure homes, in undisturbed places of rest. Though hail flattens the forest and the city is leveled completely, how blessed you will be, sowing your seed by every stream and letting your cattle and donkeys range free. This is a happy seven verses. Verse 14, the fortress will be abandoned. Well, it's a happy six verses starting in verse 15, but in verse 14, the fortress will be abandoned. Now, when does this occur? Well, I think it refers to the fortresses of the cities that Sennacherib attacked in Judah starting in 703 B.C. Barnes holds that as an option. Benson denies it. Ellicott affirms it, and the pulpit commentary denies it. It all depends on how you translate city or how you interpret city. Another option is when this was fulfilled is in the time of the Babylonian captivity in 586. Barnes mentions that as an option. Benson says that's when it was, and so does the pulpit commentary. And that's because Jerusalem was abandoned and deserted. Citadel and watchtower became a wasteland because the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem, burned it to the ground. Now, when it says it will become a wasteland forever, remember forever, olam. Olam is a Hebrew word that means for a long, long time. It can mean eternity future or eternity past, but a lot of times it just means for a long time. Sometimes it means for the length of a person's life. Sometimes it means for the length of the old covenant, but it just means a long time here. All right, so the cities around Jerusalem in Judah will have their fortresses abandoned. They will be deserted, citadel and watchtower crushed down so that it's nothing but a wasteland. The delight of donkeys, that's because donkeys like to wander around in wastelands. A pasture for flocks, that's because sheep like to do the same thing. There's no city there anymore. That's the bad news. Now, starting in verse 15, the good news. Till the Spirit is poured upon us from on high. And that, of course, refers to Hezekiah. In my interpretation, I say, of course, the times of Hezekiah, but those times of Hezekiah typify the times when the Holy Spirit is poured out upon the church in the times of the Messiah. Verse 15, till the Spirit is poured upon us from on high. Now here's some agricultural scenery, some agricultural metaphors, which tell us of how great that time's going to be. The desert becomes a fertile field. The fertile field seems like a forest because it grows so much. So the desert becomes a fertile field. That's progression. And the fertile field, which is already growing something, becomes even better, a forest. Verse 16, justice will dwell in the desert where there was no justice before. Again, that's a great symbol of Hezekiah chopping down those idols or Jesus establishing his kingdom. Righteousness will live in the fertile field referring to the kingdom of God, either Old Testament or New. That righteousness could be either the righteousness of Hezekiah's reign, or it could be the righteousness of Jesus, perfect righteousness, or it could be the righteousness of Jesus' people or Hezekiah's people. Verse 17, the fruit of that righteousness will be peace, because that's what righteousness does. It gives you peace. And I tell you, there's nothing better than peace. The effect of righteousness will be quietness and confidence forever. It's real hard to live a quiet life in this veil of tears, this unjust world that we live in, but righteousness will get you there. Verse 18, my people will live in peaceful dwelling places and secure homes and undisturbed places of rest. Perfect symbol of the times of the Messiah. Also took place during Hezekiah's time too. Verse 19, though hail flattens the forest and the city is leveled completely, how blessed you will be. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that verse 19 is very obscure, I guess, because why would we have hail flattening the forest in the time of such peace and confidence and quietness and fertility and justice? Well, that's because whether it's during the times of Hezekiah or during the times of the Messiah, the evil world still goes on and evil happens. But the point here is, though even evil happens, like hail flattening the crops or flattening the forest, something really bad happens, and the city you live in is leveled completely, but you'll still be blessed. That shows how God can protect his people in times of judgment. So many people are talking about America's getting ready to be judged, including yours truly, and I believe that, but I also believe that God's going to protect his church in the midst of it. Verse 20, not only are the righteous protected in verse 20, Isaiah says they will be blessed, sowing their seed by every stream, productive, growing fruit, letting your cattle and donkeys range free, in the midst of even the worst catastrophe. So we need to take hope. There's a lot of people that are reading Tim LaHaye and all about the 666 and the computer chips under the skin and the black helicopters and the nuclear bombs. I don't think that they are quiet and righteous. They're looking for a mythical pre-trib rapture to take them out of all the troubles that there are in this world. And they're going to be disappointed because God protects us in this world. He doesn't take us out of the world. He protects us in this world. Well, enough of my eschatological rants. Let's go back and pick up verse 15. Till the Spirit is poured on us from on high. Here are the options as to when this was fulfilled. Option number one, during a spiritual revival in Hezekiah's time. Option number two, Pentecost. Of course, if you take city as being ruined, as we see here in verse 14, then the city can't be Jerusalem. If it is Jerusalem, Jerusalem was not in ruins at Pentecost, and so you can't say the Holy Spirit fell at Pentecost. But if we assume that the city referred to here are the surrounding cities in Judah, then this outpouring of the Spirit could very well be Pentecost, and I believe it is. So, option number one, spiritual revival in Hezekiah's time is when the Spirit is outpoured. Option number two, it's Pentecost. Option number three, Hezekiah's spiritual revival is a type of Pentecost. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown agree with that. They say this outpouring of the Spirit can only partially apply to the spiritual revival in Hezekiah's time. Its full accomplishment belongs to the Christian dispensation, first at Pentecost, when the Spirit shall be poured on Israel and through it on the Gentiles. And I believe that's the correct option. Now, we can even go further than that and say it's the outpouring of the Spirit throughout the whole New Covenant age after Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70, allowing the Spirit to move all the way through the world, through Israel first and then the world. That's when the Spirit is poured out. Well, that's a speculation. I think that's too precise. Let's just say during the times of the Messiah. Some people even say that it's at the whole end of the New Covenant age before the second coming of Jesus and the establishment of the final state. And Gill speculates, well, Jerusalem could be destroyed then, speculating about the future. I'm not going to do that. I think those are off the wall interpretations of that outpouring of the Spirit. And so we're going to take it as Hezekiah's spiritual revival when he chopped down all the idols, all of which is a type for when the Spirit was poured out at Pentecost. Now in verse 15, the desert becomes a fertile field. There are two ways you can take fertile field. Fertile field can have a physical fulfillment or a spiritual fulfillment in the times of the Messiah. The physical fulfillment would be more particularly in the times of Hezekiah, as Jameson, Fawcett, Brown say, quote, Judea, so long waste, shall be populous and fruitful, and the land of the enemies of God shall be desolate. Or fertile field could refer to spiritual fulfillment in times of the Messiah. As John Gill says, such parts of the world as were like a wilderness, barren and unfruitful, producing nothing but the briars and thorns of impiety, infidelity, superstition, and idolatry should now become like a fruitful field. The gospel being now preached everywhere, multitudes of souls converted, churches raised and formed, and these filled with such as were laden with the fruits of righteousness, and such places where the gospel had been preached and professed, and where churches had been planted, and there was some good degree of fruitfulness in word and works, now should be abundantly more fruitful. That's a happy note to end on, but before I finish, I want to make one more comment about this hail in verse 19, though hail flattens the forest, but you will be blessed in verse 20. Some commentators say that that is an allusion to the hail that fell on the Egyptians, but which did not fall on the Israelites who were living in the land of Goshen in the northeast of Egypt. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that plague of hail, which hit the Egyptians but didn't hit the Israelites, that's a perfect picture of how God can selectively protect his people in the midst of judgment. How about when God judged the whole world with Noah? There were 8 people that survived it. How about when he judged Sodom and Gomorrah? Lot survived it. How about when the Babylonians burnt down Jerusalem in 586 BC? Jeremiah and some others survived it. So let's don't give up hope as we watch America swirl down the toilet. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Isaiah 32, and we are now prepared in our next audio to go to Isaiah 33, which I will call, O Lord, be gracious to us. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.